My name is John Beck, and with my colleague and friend Kurt Dewhurst, together we co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which for 17 years has been doing this brown bag series, and for nearly 21 years has been a joint effort between the Labor Education Program of the School for Human Resources and Labor Relations and the Traditional Arts Division of the MSU Museum. And we do concerts, film openings, fiction and poetry readings, different forms of exhibits, and this brown bag series, among other things. So I have a number of things to hand out as announcements before we get going. We actually have three programs in October, three brown bags. On Friday, October 12th, Maria Cristina Fava, brand new professor of musicology, is going to be talking about a very famous 1930s musical on New York called Pins and Needles that was done by the International Lady Garment Workers Union and was quite well received. And she's doing a talk called Drawing a Finer Point on 1930s Era Success, Pins and Needles in the ILGWU's Lesson for the Theater Guild. So I'll just start passing these around. Second, we're very happy in the center of the month on the 18th to have Joe McCartan here. Joe is a professor of history at Georgetown University. His new book, Collision Course, looks at the 1981 air traffic controllers strike and how it really was a major defining moment for American labor and American history. And always, sometimes on Fridays, unfortunately, we compete with the Carillon. So away we go. So I'll pass that around. That will be a wonderful talk. It's a great book. Reads almost like a mystery novel. And then Tom Marvin from Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, Ooey Pooey, as they call themselves.
They don't like to be called that, John.
I know that. This, from someone from the major...
No, we don't like to say that either.
These Indiana people, they're very picky, very, you know, thin-skinned. Here we go. Tom Marvin's coming up. Tom's been in our program before. This time he's doing a presentation called Occupy the University, Putting Student and Labor Activism in Perspective. So I think you'll find that quite interesting.
We have to have him come to Bloomington, I think.
Yeah. Then I have some flyers still for the North American Labor History Conference, which is coming up in Detroit. Joe is also going to be speaking there. If any of you are interested in, that's a wonderful conference, by the way. And last but not least is our handy dandy, everything you ever wanted to know about the Fall Brown Bag Series, but we're afraid to ask flyer, that has all of the different dates of programs coming up. We have great things for you to be part of, and we hope you do that. Now, Alex Lichtenstein is actually an amazing scholar from the point of view that it's very, very tough to keep a foot on a couple of different continents. But he's managed to do this in his work as a historian. He's done a lot of work on convict labor, civil rights, and labor here in the United States. And then he made the decision to cast his eye on a place that's very near and dear to many of our hearts, and that is the nation of South Africa and the continent of Africa. As I said to some of you who were here last time, you know, I do work in Africa as well. And the period that Alex is about to talk about is fascinating from the point of view that it really was the period that brought apartheid down. The mid-70s through the mid-80s and then beyond to the change in 1994. But the seeds of that, especially in terms of the role of workers and of unions, is right at the heart of what Alex is going to be talking to all of us about. He's a professor of history at the Department of History in Indiana University on the Bloomington main campus. In prior parts of his life, he's been at Rice University and also at Florida International University. And way back, he told me last night at the dawn of time, He did his doctorate at the University of Pennsylvania. So we're very, very happy to have Alex with us to talk to his topic today, Taming the Shop Floor in South Africa, Black Workers in the Struggle Against Apartheid, 1973 through 1985. Please help me in welcoming Alex Lichtenstein.
Thank you for the warm welcome. Thank you, John. It really is a pleasure to be here. Now, when John had asked me to come give a talk at this Brown Bag, I was doing research, as I still am, on the labor movement in South Africa in the 1970s, and as John suggested, in particular, the 1970s as the moment in which the labor role in the anti-apartheid movement within South Africa, not internationally, was born, and focusing in particular on these mass strikes in 1973 that you see up there as a key moment in the upsurge of the anti-apartheid movement that I think has been relatively neglected in favor of 1976 and the far better known Soweto revolt. So in part I was trying to rethink the history of the anti-apartheid movement from a labor history slash working class history perspective. Now, of course, when I agreed to give this talk, I couldn't know what was gonna happen on August 16th, 2012, which unfortunately makes this talk all the more relevant, because I imagine most of you, at least, know that currently, starting with that date, really, August 16th, which is going to enter South African history, along with February 1973, these strikes, June 1976, Soweto, March 1960, Sharpeville, and so on. Now we're going to have August 2012, Marikana, which is when the ANC post-apartheid government massacred 34 striking miners. And this image is from 1973 in a very similar, although far more widespread, strike. At that moment. However, if you've been following the news, the strike in Marikana and the platinum mines, which if we have a chance at the end we can talk about, is just one of many labor conflicts that seems to be brewing in both gold and platinum mines of South Africa right now. So this talk has sort of a deeper contemporary relevance. Now, what I want to try and do, and this is what I would have done anyway, is trace the birth of the current South African trade union movement and its place in the anti-apartheid moment of the 80s and its place within what's now the current governing coalition of South Africa, the Tripartite Alliance of the African National Congress, COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the main trade union federation, the AFL-CIO, if you will, of South Africa, although rhetorically far to the left of the AFL-CIO. And the South African Communist Party. That's the official tripartite governing alliance of South Africa. And one of the questions, and this question really is on the agenda, if you go and look, COSATU has just had their 11th all-in conference this week, and what the place of COSATU is in this alliance, its relationship to the government, to the ANC, and to the South African Communist Party, was very much the center of discussion this past week, all right? And in part that reprises a set of issues and conflicts that were central, I would say, to the place of the labor movement in the anti-apartheid movement itself in the 1970s. So what I want to try and do is trace out for you the dynamics of the labor movement, its relationship to the liberation movement and to the state in the 1970s leading up to 1985 or so, which is when COSATU is essentially officially born, but I'm more interested in that sort of pre-COSATU period. And what I want to do in this talk is chart for you three competing tendencies inside the process that made the modern South African labor movement. One tendency, for lack of a better term, I would call Leninist, okay? And if you go look at COSATU's website today, they still like to quote Lenin. They do so in some of their documents. But when I say Leninist in this context, what I'm referring to essentially is the doctrine that the trade union movement and its apparatus will fundamentally be subordinated to a political project by the leading vanguard political party. All right? That's in rough terms what I mean when I say Lenin. That is, trade union goals are subordinated to the larger, in the South African case, goals of what was called, and still to this day is called, the National Democratic Revolution, led by the African National Congress and the South African Communist Party, with the trade union as sort of a central part of that, but fundamentally a follower rather than a leader. I think that's fair to say. That's one tendency, all right? Another tendency is one that I hope you heard last week, if you came to a talk last week, which is a syndicalist tendency, a notion that workers' power and working class power does not flow from a leading political party or from the state or from capturing the state, but is rooted in the ordinary activities of the working class at the point of production, in the workplace, in the shop, in the factory, in the mine. All right, that's a syndicalist ideal, right? And that's one that was born in the South African trade unions at this very moment in 1973, in this essentially spontaneous movement of mass strikes by ordinary rank and file workers without any representation, without unions in their workplaces, and indeed without a legal structure that even allowed them to join recognized and accepted unions in South Africa. So that syndicalist tendency was, and I would say is, very important in South African labor relations. And finally, another tendency, which up until the 1970s was a separate or extremely racialized tendency, which was a corporatist tendency. The irony about South African industrial relations in the 20th century is that for whites, and essentially also at times for so-called colored and Asian people, this was a highly corporatized labor system with a lot of recognition by the state. I would say that the South African state was well in advance of the American state when it came to creating a labor relations bureaucracy and making a fully legitimized, recognized role for trade unions in the state apparatus and in workplace negotiations. That occurred in South Africa for whites about 10 years before it occurred in the United States. Okay, it occurred in the 1920s for whites. So the thing to understand, and one of the things I've been doing in my research, is looking at how this dualistic system of industrial relations evolved over the 20th century. A highly corporatized system with full recognition of trade union rights, with industrial council systems, with tripartite bargaining between state, union, and employees, and pattern bargaining national level. That's what operated for whites. And a very different kind of industrial relations system, an apartheid industrial relations system, a separate one for African workers, particularly from the 1950s on. Now, what happens in the 1970s, as I'm going to explain, in the wake of these strikes, is the gradual reformist effort of the apartheid state to begin to try to absorb African workers, to let African workers in the door of this corporatized national system of labor relations, all right, akin to, in some ways, far in advance of, I would say, the National Labor Relations Board and the sort of legitimation of negotiation and collective bargaining that we're familiar with in the United States. All right, so all three of those tendencies, the Leninist tendency, the syndicalist tendency, and the corporatist tendency, essentially came into this crucible of a political moment in South African labor history in the 1970s, touched off at first by these mass strikes that look a lot like Marikana. I mean, you see this picture, and if I didn't tell you this was 1973, you might almost imagine it being the Marikana strike. I mean, the images are very, very similar. These mass strikes that spread from the industrial suburbs, essentially, of Durban, which is on the southeast coast along the Indian Ocean, and by the end of March, 100,000 workers had stopped work. And what I'm interested in is how these strikes actually provoke a reformist response from both the state and from employers. All right? And out of these strikes grows an organized labor movement for Africans. All right, so the background, I already sketched some of this, but again, this dualistic system, highly corporatist system of labor relations, collective bargaining, and negotiation governed by what are called industrial councils, industry by industry, for white workers only. Black workers from 1953 on were governed in their shop floor relations, in the factories, and as I explained to the two Peters in my podcast interview this morning, you had a system that was set up for African workers that did govern industrial relations. We spent a lot of time in South African history thinking about labor migration, justifiably so, influx control, as it was called, the efforts of the state to regulate where Africans could go and under what terms they could migrate from the rural homelands to which they were confined into the industrial heartland of South Africa, where they would be regarded as guest workers, temporary sojourners. This was the migrant labor system that was absolutely central to South African capitalism, and that some observers have noted seems to still be central to the platinum industry, for example, which depends on migrant labor from hundreds and hundreds of miles away. But South African labor historians have spent so much time looking at the migrant labor system and the efforts to control the flow of labor that they haven't paid sufficient attention to how the apartheid state set up an apparatus designed to govern industrial relations inside the workplace, particularly as manufacturing grew in importance compared to mining. All right, so it's in the 60s and 70s in the South African economy that you see the growth of secondary manufacturing as absolutely central, less dependent on migrant labor, much less dependent, of course, on export commodities like mining is, much more dependent on the creation of a stable working class, and perhaps even, and certainly I've got lots of interesting evidence from the managerial side of the ledger, of a desire for a Fordist breakthrough, right? A sense that we're making all these products, but our workers are so deeply underpaid that they can't buy the products. Our working class is fundamentally being paid starvation wages. That's fine if we're trying to export gold at a fixed price, but if we're trying to sell manufactured goods internally to South Africa, which is how you grow our economy, you know, white people are only going to buy so many automobiles in South Africa because there are only so many of them to go around. The vast majority of the population, if it can't purchase these consumer goods, and that's what the old system of apartheid depended on, where is South African capitalism going to go? These were the far-sighted leaders of South African capitalism. Not all of them, but in the 60s and 70s, and one of the most interesting parts of my research has been looking at the managerial literature, quite frankly, and discovering this dawning recognition on the part of the South African manufacturing class that apartheid had profound limitations in terms of a system that was going to promote capitalist growth beyond some sort of export and primary mineral sectors. All right, now, the government's beginning to realize this as well. And so when these strikes break out, let me back up a minute. Okay, so the system that's designed to regulate African workers on the shop floor is controlled by the Department of Labor. It's completely outside the ambit of this collective bargaining system set up for whites. And instead, it's called the Native Settlement of Disputes Act. African workers cannot join unions. Their unions are not recognized by the state. They cannot go on strike, and if they go on strike, the police are called. But before the police are called, the employer picks up the phone and he calls the local native labor officer, who in each province had their own little native labor board, and the employer calls up the native labor officer, and the native labor officer jumps in his car and he drives down to the factory and he says to the workers, "What's your problem?" And they say, "You know, the boss isn't paying us enough." And he goes to the boss, he says, "You know, they say you're not paying." And he tries to sort of mediate on the ground in the midst of these essentially illegal wildcat strikes. And the research I did on the 1950s shows that this ridiculous system, which is designed explicitly, as the planners of it said, to bleed the African unions to death, the informal African unions that did slightly exist in the 40s and the 50s, this ridiculous system that doesn't work as a system of modern labor negotiations actually can be used by African workers in some instances. They're not always brutally repressed. Sometimes the native labor officer comes into the scene and he says to the boss, "You know what? you probably should pay these guys a little more. You know what, maybe if they're doing dangerous work, they should be provided with gloves, that sort of thing, all right? So there are moments, I'm not really being facetious, there are moments in which African workers are able to use this very flimsy apparatus of industrial relations designed just for them and designed to make sure that they can't create unions. They're still able to use it. The key institution that the Native Settlements of Dispute Act sets up in the 50s and beyond is called the Works Committee. This is an informal workplace committee. It's a company union, essentially, okay? Set up by the firm, and it's a single plant committee, but it is where these issues, safety, conditions of work, hours, wages, grievances, and so forth, might have a slight outlet. That's the system as it's established in 1953. Now, what happens in the wake of these mass strikes? It shows both employers and the government that that system, the Native Settlement of Disputes Act and the works committees as they currently existed, few and far between, was not working. There's a general consensus. One of the things that's quite amazing about these strikes, especially when you compare them to Soweto, for instance, they are not physically repressed by the state. I know that sounds unusual. We're talking about 1973. This is the apartheid state at the absolute height of its power. I would say it's the pinnacle of the power of the state to repress black protests circa 1973 in South Africa. And yet, actually what happened last month was far more brutal. There were 34 workers killed at Marikana. I don't know how many were killed in the response to the 73 strikes, but less than 34. 100,000 workers go on strike in the first 3 months of 1973, all right? 353 are arrested. 353 are arrested. That's remarkable. In a police state, which South Africa most certainly was in 1973, the police could arrest whoever they wanted and detain them for as long as they pleased in 1973. So one of the things, and I know this isn't always a popular thing to say, but one of the things that struck me about these strikes is precisely they are not physically repressed within the context of the latitude that the South African state has to do so at that time. And one question I'm not entirely sure what the answer is why not? But one potential answer, the employers are English-speaking in Natal, in Durban. The state, of course, is National Party of the Afrikaners. They're perfectly happy. And you can go look at the Afrikaans press, it's fantastic. They have a field day. Ah, these Englishmen, they're always telling us how terrible we are with apartheid. Now look at them, they're paying starvation wages to their workers. So this is a great opportunity for the Afrikaners to say, well, if it were up to us, but it's you guys, employers, who have to raise the wages. Bingo, the wages are raised. The Nats, the ruling party, the Afrikaner nationalists, don't have to take any political responsibility for this fact with their political constituency, the white working class in particular, right? It's those nasty English employers. So it's, that may be why. And I actually, when I was in South Africa last, I got a great story from a guy named Alex Mouton, historian. I don't know if you've met Alex, but his father was a police sergeant in Natal in the 70s. And so he told me this story where his father gets called up by an English language employer saying, oh, my workers are striking. Can you please send the cops down here to like bust their heads? And he said, his father said, no. That's your problem, leave me alone. He hung up the phones in the middle of the night. And I don't know if this is true or not, but it captures the sense of, you know, Afrikaners were perfectly happy to see the English-speaking capitalists who voted for the United Party usually and were always complaining about apartheid while they were benefiting from it to be hoisted on their own petard. Very interesting moment, okay. That's a long way of saying, however, that 1973 opens up the question. How will South African capitalism move forward if African workers continue to be paid starvation wages? And the collective decision was it can't, all right? And then the question became, so how do we improve the situation? And for employers in particular, they keep speaking about what we need. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Basically, okay? We need more lines of communication. If our workers are unhappy, we have no way of knowing that. because there's no outlet, there's no recognized system. The Native Labor Board is not only comes in after the fact when there's a strike. There's no grievance procedure. There's no union. Now, the liberal historiography likes to say, ah, thank God for those open-minded liberal employees who threw open the factory doors and invited the South African radical trade union movement to organize their workers and to build these strong unions. That's what helped end apartheid. Bullshit, okay? No, they wanted to reform the system, no question about it. But the deeper I dig into this, the one thing that employers, no matter how liberal they said they were, did not want in the 1970s was to invite trade unions into their factories. To the degree that they were willing to do that, the only way they could countenance it would be to say, yes, if black workers organize a union, it will have to be what's called a parallel union under the wing of the responsible white trade union in their particular industry. For Americanists, I think this probably sounds familiar, right? If you know the history of racialized trade unions in the United States and in the South in particular, there was at a particular moment this idea of biracial trade unionism, right? Where white unions like the Boilermakers, ironically enough, they were just as bad in South Africa as they were in the United States. The Boilermakers Union during World War II in the United States said, okay, all these black workers are coming to the shipyards. We'll allow them to organize auxiliary unions. But we'll do all the bargaining for them because they're not responsible because they don't really know about trade unionism. Same language that you see by the white trade unions in the 1970s in South Africa, who would be very happy to collect membership dues from African workers, who would be very happy to make sure that African workers aren't going to undercut them in the workplace and take their jobs, but sure as hell don't want African workers creating an independent union structure that will outflank the white trade unions as they existed. And those are the liberal white trade unions, by the way. The conservative white trade unions say, no, absolutely not. African workers should not be able now nor ever to join a trade union in South Africa. After all, they're residents of KwaZulu or Venda. They don't even live in South Africa. They're just here as temporary guest workers, right? H2 workers in American terms. That's, if you want to understand from an American perspective how apartheid worked, crudely speaking, right? The idea was to try and transform the African proletariat in South Africa into H2 workers, guest workers who had no rights as citizens or employees within the Republic of South Africa, but rather were only rights-bearing individuals back in their fake state that was created for them as the Bantustan or the homeland. All right. Now, the reformist response, not unions. This is after 1973. I've looked closely at the legislative process. Let's expand that great system of works committees. That's how we can get more cooperation in the workplace and more communication. How long do I have, John? When do you want me to stop? Okay. And here you have this explosion of this committee structure. Now, two things are very interesting about this, right? First, much to my surprise, the apartheid state, the government, the Afrikaners, actually introduced more liberal of a program in 1973 than the employers wanted. They said, that is the initial legislation said, we need to expand the works committees. The works committees, although they still are single plant, have only workers on them. And they're elected by workers. These are shop floor organizations that, from one point of view, certainly could be called a company union, but from another point of view, might be called a shop steward council, for example, okay? The employers say, no, 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 what are you doing? You're inviting the nucleus of militant trade unions into our workplace. We prefer this other beast called the liaison committee. That has half workers and half people appointed by management. Much better. That will facilitate communication much more easily. And as you can see, most South African employers were happy to invite liaison committees into their workplace, but were not that thrilled about the alternative works committees. And tracing, and this, Peter, is why looking at Hansard, looking at the parliamentary debates over this legislation is fascinating. This is, again, this is why we don't want to just take the apartheid state as some monolith, some evil monolith. It was within its very bounded apparatus, a democratic state. All right? And in this case, I feel that the employers actually hindered the reform of labor relations, or certainly tried to make them less democratic than they would have been under the Afrikaner legislation that it's introduced. Now, neither one of these, the state nor the employers, has any interest in permitting African trade unions to be born in response to the 73 strikes. But yet, you can see that the employer-dominated liaison committee structure with their quote, and this is from a, you know, employer, anti-polarization with benefits such as better guidance by management. So again, you have the language that, well, you know, we're all for trade unions, but the African worker isn't ripe for it yet, all right? And never will be, is the implication, all right? But Phil Yawn, the Minister of Labor, was quite clear, right? This is not going to open up the recognition of African trade unions. He couldn't have been more wrong, okay? That's in 1970, and this just again is from the business press, which is a great place to look. This is from People and Profits, which is put out by an outfit called the Institute of Personnel Management. Another thread of this story that I'm very interested in finding is precisely how the South African managerial class sets up in the 1970s, often in really thorough communication with the managerial and human relations gurus on this side of the Atlantic. I'm trying to find out more about this, but these guys who are running, for instance, the Institute of Personnel Management, they're coming to American business schools to learn how we do human relations. How do you manage people with the velvet glove instead of the iron fist, right? And that velvet glove, my sense again, reading the South African managerial press, that velvet glove frequently was made in America. All right, it's a very interesting connection. I haven't fully traced it, but it's definitely there, even from the early 60s on. All right. Now, of course, within the South African workers' movement, there was a good deal of skepticism about these works committees as a reformist structure. And many of them, but particularly those people aligned with the ANC and with SACTU, the South African Congress of Trade Unions, the communist-oriented trade union structure that would largely only existed in exile by the mid-1970s, and was very, very ambivalent about the 1973 strikes, much the way that COSATU today is very uncomfortable with the Marikana strikes, because they're strikes that are not emanating from the center, that are not being directed by the established trade union or political party. They're bubbling up from below. Trade unions don't like this, usually. Most of you who follow this sort of stuff know. But many African workers were skeptical about the possibility of the works committees. But I found this counter-tendency, which is that some far-seeing people, and this also included some radical white students who came out of what's called NUSAS, the National Union of South African Students, some of them thought, aha, here's an opening. And again, for those of you who know American labor history, to me, this is exactly like what's going on in 1933 and 1934 under Section 7A of the National Industrial Relations Act, which says, you know, which creates this thing that allows unions to be created in the American workplace, but management says, well, we'll give you a company union. And all the people who flow into those company unions in 33 and 34, guess what? They're shop stewards and CIO unions 3 years later. And I thought, I wonder if that's what's going on here. And I think it is what was going on here. All right? I've managed to trace, I can skip by this, but here you see that the syndical, that this is where the syndicalist element in South African trade unions is born. Boring from within through this very, very tenuous apparatus set up by the state and by employers that some workers say, you know what? Maybe we should join the workers' committee. We can turn it our direction. Okay? And so I identified, and I'm trying to identify more, but I've certainly identified more than a handful of South African workers in some of these striking workplaces in 1973 who then join a works committee. This one's at Frametex, which is essentially where these mass strikes are born in the textile industry. And then later on, in the late 70s, emerge as shop stewards once the unions can essentially emerge from underground into full recognition, which is the next phase of reforms. So my argument, and here is where I think not everyone is going to find this persuasive, but I'm pretty persuaded of it, is that these works committees can serve as kind of the opportunity to build the new society in the shell of the old, all right? And again, this is not by any means the ANC and Soktu and the kind of Leninist narrative of the relationship between the Vanguard political party and the trade unions is that workers rejected these sham committees and moved ahead toward the revolution. I'm not convinced of that, okay? Now, the end game of the 1970s, pushed forward in part by Soweto, yes, is a recognition that this sort of piecemeal effort to reform the South African industrial relations regime was fundamentally not going to work, okay? And that some more dramatic reform was necessary, in part because of international pressure, right? From the ILO, from the ICFTU, from the US State Department, and most importantly from the divestment movement, right? That so the Vihan Commission, which is created in 1977, holds 2 years of hearings, talks to hundreds of people across South Africa, takes testimony, and again, incredibly rich archival material. All of the testimony, all of the submissions to the Vihan Commission are sitting there in Pretoria in the National Archives. As far as I know, no one has looked at these. I've looked at them, but very few other people have looked at them as far as I can tell. Continuing shop floor conflict and the desire to create industrial peace, the desire for international legitimacy, and anxiety about the growing strength of these works committees all lead the Vihan Commission in the direction of trying to eliminate that old-fashioned dualism in South African labor relations and to draw African workers into a corporatist industrial relations regime, so where they will essentially be drawn into that national level of pattern bargaining through the industrial council system, in which they are envisioned fundamentally as junior partners, especially to the responsible white trade union. So the Vihan Commission concludes on May 1st, 1979, African workers should be fully recognized as employees. There's a bit of negotiation over whether this will include migrant workers or not. That's another important story, but that African unions will be allowed to register with the state and join the corporatist industrial council system, and that job reservation, segregated jobs for whites only, keeping blacks out, will be ended. Or at least state-mandated job reservation. They're a bit ambiguous about the closed shop and the efforts of whites to voluntarily restrict union membership to whites only. But state-mandated segregation will certainly end. This is what Vihan recommends, and the government accepts many of, if not all, of the recommendations. Both the right and the left denounce the Vihan Commission vociferously. You have, what's his name? Ari Paulus, the leader of the White Mine Workers Union in 1979. They strike, they go on a political strike against this commission's report. And he says, this is the worst blow against the white worker that the state has done since 1922, which is the first time that the South African state, then under Smuts, used armed force to physically repress a working class revolt of white workers in that case. Maybe not the first time. Peter will correct me if that's not the first time. One of the most important times, okay? A moment in South African labor history that is elemental in labor history, because that is when the state uses armed force to kill South African miners. White miners in that instance. And Ari Paulus says, the Vihan Commission is doing this all over again. The left, ANC, SACTU, the Communist Party, they also denounce the Vihan Commission as essentially a Potemkin village, they probably wouldn't use that term, a sop being thrown to the West to pretend that they're reforming labor relations. Well, what they're really trying to do is control and eliminate black trade unions that have been born in this moment since 1973. Grain of truth there, because certainly the Vihan Commission was hoping to tame and control these black unions, but I think that the left, again, as they had with the works committees, didn't fully recognize the opportunity that this was opening up for the South African working class. The intentions of the Vihan Commission certainly were very conservative, but as with the committee system, I would argue the consequences were far more complex, all right? Now, the most important thing about the Vihan Commission, and I'll try and wrap up there, is that it eliminated this system of dualism in South African industrial relations. Not just dualism by race, but also it tried to eliminate this dualism by by location. A set of industrial labor relations that were carried out through these industrial councils at the industry level, through pattern bargaining, highly corporatist, and this shop floor power which had been built in the interstices of this movement by African workers. They want to eliminate that dualism. And what the Vihan Commission, and here I think is where, you know, this is what I've been working on the last couple months, and this is what I think I'm contributing to this discussion. The Vihan Commission is not so much eager to destroy black trade unionism as to drive it or corral it into the corporatist mold of the industrial council system and to truncate its power that it built up through these committees at the shop floor level. All right, so that's really what the Vihan Commission and what employers want the Vihan Commission to do, is to cut off at the pass the growing tendency of African, organized African workers to strike these non-corporatist and almost unrecognized sub rosa bargains with their employers through their ability to exercise shop floor power, syndicalist type union organization, all right? This meant that for the unions, they faced a tough choice. Should they take the road that the state is offering them, legitimation, full recognition, potentially stop orders, right? That, you know, dues checkoff, the ability to engage in collective bargaining at the national level through these industrial councils? Or was that actually, you know, tainted fruit, which many people argued, right? Should they register with the state or not? This becomes the enormous debate in the early 1980s. Should the shop floor agreements which they are striking with their employers on an ad hoc basis, should those be subordinated to these national agreements founded at the IC level or not? FOSATU, which in many ways is the predecessor to COSATU, the Federation of South African Trade Unions, created in 79 and 80, argued, quote, employers want African workers to negotiate at a place where they are weak and not in individual facilities where they are strong. Okay? Now, I'm going to leave it at that, but these struggles in the 70s to define the direction of the South African trade union movement, to map out its relationship with the state and with the liberation movement, and to determine at what level it was going to attempt to exercise working class power, all of those debates have come back to haunt the alliance, really over the last few years, but Marikana has been this flash of lightning, I think, that has cast these debates into bright relief. COSATU, or certainly COSATU's membership, certainly the trade union movement in South Africa as a larger entity, has several characteristics which date back to the 1970s. One, a deep suspicion of the state. Okay? Two, an intense commitment to workplace democratic proceduralism. Again, one of the things I didn't have time to talk about today, but that I'm tracing in the 1970s, is how these works committees actually inducted African workers into the democratic procedure of South African trade unionism, even when they were dominated by employers. It meant that, and we were talking about this last night, John, it meant that workers themselves had to discuss, what do we need? Who are we going to put forward to ask the employer for it? If the, when the employer responds to our shop steward, essentially, he has to come back to us and tell us what they said. And then we'll decide whether that's adequate or not. It's a really democratic union. Right? This is why Rahm Emanuel almost, you know, lost his mind when he discovered this is not how he works, when he discovered that, oh, guess what? CTU has to actually vote on this contract. He expected Karen Lewis to just go back and say, all right, we have a contract, let's go, back to work. Right? That's what Rahm expected. And he was actually shocked when she didn't do that. This is my reading of what happened last week, right? He couldn't believe it. And she was like, no, you know, we have to vote on this, and we can't expect people to vote on it until we actually know what the contract says. But Rahm just thought she was going to shove it down their throats because he thought that a union worked the way he works, right? That was his reading of it. And he didn't understand that. So this is what is born in the South African trade union movement and that sense of shop floor power. The problem is that are these tendencies deeply embedded, I would say, in the DNA of the South African labor movement, at least at the grassroots level, Are they compatible with the larger structural problems? The fact that fundamentally COSATU is wedded to the African National Congress, and they are a junior partner, no matter how much they try and deny it. Okay? They are part of this tripartite alliance that actually, when push comes to shove, does not engage in political, economic, or fiscal policies that are very good for working class people in South Africa. And COSATU continues to go along with it because politically it's where their bread is buttered. And finally, it all rests on a corporatist model of bargaining, which the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers, has been engaged in with the platinum barons for the last several years, which is why, and Peter asked me this morning, it seems very, if not entirely, predictable that there would be a grassroots explosion at a place like Marikana this year, just as there was a grassroots explosion at Durban in 1973. This graph, which I'll finish with, shows the price of platinum. Guess what? The World Bank / International Finance Corporation floated a loan to Lonmin Corporation of $200 million, right about then. Why did they loan this money to Lonmin? Because Lonmin said, we are a socially responsible corporation that is going to develop this region of South Africa. We have a great environmental record. We're going to help with housing. We're going to combat AIDS. We're going to uplift the African working class. That was in 2007. The people that Lonmin must have had working for them, because you can go online and find the extensive corporate reports demonstrating what a beautiful thing this company is and how they are going to charge in there and turn Marikana and Rustenburg and Northwest Province into a living paradise for the African working class. And they really laid it on pretty thick. And the IFC bought it and floated up $200 million in loan credits to them in 2007. All right, and that's sort of where the story picks up today. All right, I hope I left some time for questions. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you, Alex, for that. I happen to, you look down at your notes and you forget what you needed to say. Three quick announcements. First of all, there are sign-in sheets. Please keep on circulating them and sign in, please. Number two, on October 6th, the Michigan Oral History Association is meeting at the Monroe County Labor History Museum for their annual conference. Please do come. And then, this talk is co-sponsored by the African Studies Center. Thank you, James and John, everyone else who's connected to the center. And is one of the last things that we're doing this year in honor of the 100th anniversary of the African National Congress. With that, let me open it to questions.
Thank you.
This is a very good question, Peter. And in terms of my own research so far, as you suggested, I mean, I've looked pretty closely at the 1950s, and I have a pretty good handle on the 70s. But for me, at this point, the 60s remains something of a black hole. And so everything you say about the 50s is correct. There's all sorts of ferment. But I'm not sure what's happening in the workplace. I mean, again, the standard issue argument is, quiescence. Nothing's happening between 1960 or at least 1964 and 1973. But of course, that's not true, right? So how do you begin to track that? One place, although I've only looked at it very briefly, is to continue to follow these Native Labor Board hearings, essentially. And those are very rich, and they do interview workers, so you get a sense of what workers are saying and thinking and demanding. And those persist, although less often than they did in the 50s, into the 60s. So I just haven't had time. So next time I go back to South Africa, I'm going to look at those records again to try and get a sense of that. Another thing that's very interesting is that, of course, there's one argument against what you're saying, or one question is, who are the workers, right? Are they migrant workers who really don't see themselves as attached to a particular workplace? They come and go, but really their consciousness is formed as subjects, as Mamdani would argue, right? And he argues this totally incorrectly, in my view, about the 73 strikes. And really what's going on in the 70s is that these African workers are not fundamentally proletarianized. Their consciousness isn't rooted as an urban modern people attached to a workplace or industrial labor. It's really back in the reserves. The problem with that argument is, one, I just don't think it's true that as many of these workers lived, in KwaZulu, which was about 3 miles away from Hammersdale and Pinetown and Durban, if you look at a map. Another thing is, the manufacturing working class in South Africa, in order to have the best way to get those Section 10 residential rights, the loophole through the influx control laws, was very straightforward. You worked for the same employer for 10 years. A lot of these workers by 1973, and I have some numbers that show this, had worked for the same employer for a long, long time. So one of the answers, one may be, again, extrapolating from what I know about American labor history, is a kind of a 1933, 1934 moment in the textile industry, for instance, where paternalism broke down. All right? So it may be that in the 60s there's a certain bargain that is struck. Now again, this doesn't get to your final question, is what is the memory there? But one of the things to look at is the persistence of workers in a particular workplace over a pretty long stretch of time in the 1960s in order to gain those residential rights. And I do think that's going on. So then finally, all right, so how now in 2012, how can we excavate the memories of people who might have worked in a factory from about 1964 through 1973, and what their sense of what the possibilities for struggle were. I'm not really sure how to get at that myself. I mean, and one of the missing pieces for me is I want to go do some detailed oral histories. One person I interviewed, but again, a Saktu person, was Billy Nair. I can't remember when he went to Robben Island, but he was a Saktu activist in the 50s. So he spelled it out for me very clearly. He said it didn't really matter what the laws and rules of unionization were. We would just organize a shop floor committee, and we would go to the employer, and we would say, okay, we're building a union here, so you should negotiate with us. And a lot of the time, the employers would agree and would strike a deal with us informally, right? And I think that's going on in the 60s. But again, that's leadership. And what you're asking, Peter, is of course the most important question and the one that's hardest to get at. So,
yeah. If I can just build on that, and then I've got James and Peter and others over to Laura as well. One thing that Peter's question raises to a degree is the degree to which there is a thread that runs through history from one movement to the next movement to the next movement to the next movement. How conscious workers are in one period of what happened in earlier periods. And whether or not, for example, there are leaders who learned it that a CIO leader happened to learn it at the knee of an IWW leader.
Right.
And that a student, per Huron statement, student learned it at the knee of a CIO organizer, and so forth, right? So there's this thread issue. And it's interesting because I think one argument that can be made about what you've laid out about 1973 is that the truth of the matter is, a lot of these folks, it is a spontaneous movement by people who very well may not
See, I actually, I know, Peter, you might not, this might not be congenial to you, but my suspicion is that it's a rupture. And then, in fact, a lot of the memory has been snuffed out by exile, by the power of the state, by the fact that, you know, these workers had been recruited after 1964. I don't know, but it seems to me very possible that there's actually a rupture at that moment rather than a continuity. Yes.
They talk about their, if you like, their colleagues, their friends, their comrades, their heroes, and they talk about Mandela, they talk about the Thule, they might even later talk about the Thule, and it's whole, I think it's both. I think it's ruptures and continuity, always in history. So you can, at different times, quite right, maybe you emphasize one over the other, but the other one never entirely disappears. Don't think that we wrote the ANC out of history in the 70s.
Yes. They came from Sussex.
Yeah.
And East Berlin.
Okay, I've got James, I've got Peter, I've got Laura, and then we'll see who had Neil.
I was just going to add, there's some ways in which this doesn't remind me of Americani at all. In that there's so many women there.
Yes.
And usually when I hear, and I only dabble in the subject, when I hear about labor and movements in South Africa, it's always about men and metals and mines. So if you were to re-give this lecture through a gendered lens, are there different readings?
Yes. Right. Well, right. I mean, because this is a very different, this is not Americana. It's not an isolated mining community way out in the provinces. This is why I think Mamdani is wrong. This is a deeply embedded urban dwelling African community where A, there are many, many female workers in the textile industry, for example, around Durban, and B, most of the workers are there with their families, not as long-distance migrant male workers, right? And again, you can find, there's some very interesting studies of Durban in this period where you can see exactly this, that there's a small group of long-distance migrant commuters, male workers, but they're confined to one corner of the city. The people working in these factories ringing the city, yeah, they're men and women, right? And they're in family structures. So that, you're absolutely right. And that's a very important moment that draws women into the trade union movement. But in a way, you know, again, if you look at the food and canning industry in the Western Cape in the 1950s, and that's one of the best examples of where the left is able to build multiracial union structures. The leadership in that case was actually female. So there is another story here, which is one that, again, I think by shifting the story away from the mines and away from the question of migrant labor, that does allow a more nuanced and gendered perspective to enter into the narrative, for sure.
Okay, Peter Ledgy, and then back to Laura, and then
building on this very point, I'd like to hear more about the local specificities of Durban and the area today with how Portugal and Carl. It is a particular place. There is a reason, perhaps, why the strikes happen in Durban and not, say, in the Strand or in the Western Cape, at least in my mind. The presence of women, perhaps, connected to the textile industry there. There's a chemical industry there that's obviously quite large still today, with mining, there's the paper industry, etc. I'm also thinking of the fact that many of these African workers' first language was usually Zulu.
Yeah. Yeah.
Area and around there. And a lot of these working class folks are actually imbibing and embracing and, the black consciousness and its effect on their political consciousness and activism very directly.
very complex set of questions. Right? So one, as I already alluded to, the social geography of Durban, because the so-called homeland of KwaZulu, where the Zulu peoples are technically designated as residents slash citizens of that, as Peter knows, is cheek by jowl with the urban industrial enclave of Durban. I think that's a fair description. Very, very different. So that so-called commuter or migrant workers are just going to work on a daily basis a few miles. I think that's correct, right? And so I do think that social geography is very, very important to this. Two, relatively, not entirely, but relatively ethnic homogeneity amongst Zulu peoples who are in this community. Now, one of the questions then, these strikes actually are at first led explicitly by Zulu workers with sort of a sense of, you know, striking Zulus, and they call on, is it Buthelezi and then Barney Dladla, who's the Minister of Labor, I believe, for KwaZulu at that time, to come mediate the strike. So one of the questions I haven't been able to answer fully yet is how it is that a strike that really had a pretty heavy ethnic component to it, at least in its early days, was transformed into a mass strike that broke those bounds and extended beyond that. So that essentially the Zulu leadership in KwaZulu was not able to step forward and speak in the name of these workers, which is what some of the employers in the state were hoping, as a matter of fact. So the other dimension here, of course, those of you who know South African history, is there's a large Indian working class in Durban in this time. And this is something a question I haven't been able to answer. There's a lot of conflicting evidence, right? So some of the Indian workers come out on strike as well. The employers say, oh, they're just being intimidated. Now, you know, in 1949, which in 1973, talk about memory, Peter. I mean, people in the Indian community, when they see this in 1973, when they see Zulu walking down the street carrying weapons, they're not happy because there, you know, it's only been 24 years before there was a pogrom, essentially, of my view of it, but certainly the way the Indian community remembered it, truly or correctly or incorrectly, was a pogrom carried out by Zulu, by Africans against Indians, right? That's 1949 riot. So I think that's in people's memory. So where the Indian workers have a little bit more access to the industrial relations machinery as it already exists. So that's a complexity of the social geography of migrancy, which I think really tends toward creating a sort of an urban dwelling, family-based, localized proletariat working these factories. You have strong homogeneity, therefore Zulu ethnic consciousness, but then you have the workforce shot through with this major ethnic difference, Indians, which has a history of extreme conflict in the area. So the truth is that it's quite remarkable, I would say, that these strikes, and one of the things is these strikes didn't last very long. That is, we can say, 100,000 workers went on strike. The average strike lasted 2 days. These are quick wildcats, they're over quickly. It's hard to know what would have happened if there had been, you know, and they're rolling strikes. So it's not one long-term strike that lasts over weeks or months. That might have been a different situation that could have inflamed ethnic tensions considerably. What's remarkable to me is that one of the few studies, I mean, one of the questions both of you are asking, this is really the only on-the-ground, at-the-moment study. Sorry for the poor reproduction. And it's a wonderful document. No question, put together by the IIE, the Institute for Industrial Education, which was founded by this radical political science professor at University of Natal, Rick Turner, who had a series of students, radical white students, who then went into the trade union movement. And you know, Dave Hempson, people like that, many of Johnny Copeland, I mean, they're all over South Africa still to this day. This tends to be a view that people don't like to hear, but when push came to shove, Peter, my sense is that this outfit and their militants had much more on-the-ground role than the BC people. I think you're right that, you know, that the workers in these communities certainly have a sense of, you know, a nationalist consciousness and sort of a radical consciousness that's being promoted by BC, by Black consciousness, by BICO. That's certainly in the air. But as an organizational presence, I just don't see it. I know people disagree with this, and you know, and they say, oh, but the Black Consciousness Movement had this, I forget what it's called, but they had their own outfit set up for black workers. It really wasn't doing much, unless I'm totally missing something, right? But anyhow, these people, they didn't, it's easy in retrospect, there were a lot of questions they could have asked that they didn't ask in this study. And so it's very hard to go back and get at these things, is my sense. But so one can mine this, and there's some interesting stuff in here about Zulu consciousness, about black consciousness, about what workers were thinking and feeling, the degree to which this was an ethnic versus a class-based strike, and so forth. But it's limited, and there may be other materials that I need to unearth, but they're hard to come by.
Laura and then Neil.
So maybe to go a little bit on James's comment and to bring that, you know, that earlier picture and the whole question of the community involvement to put these strikes back in, it strikes me that one of the great political achievements of industrial trade unionism is the ability to limit the issues that are under discussion. It's wages, it's working conditions on the shop floor. It's not housing. It's not plumbing, it's not sewage, it's not whether your kids have school or your wife has health care, okay? And so it strikes me that one of the reasons for that marriage between the ANC and CP and COSATU was that COSATU could take care of those workplace issues, those wage issues, right? And the ANC could say, once we've got black coal, we will take care of those other things. Since 94, it's clear they have not delivered, right? So maybe, I guess my question is really, what does that say about the future of this alliance or marriage?
Well, in fact, well, many people think that, and in fact, one of the things that really, really surprised me when I was looking at the COSATU political report this week, they canvassed their own members. So when they did this 5 years ago, 14% of their membership thought that maybe the COSATU should leave the alliance. That figure is now up to 25%. That's pretty dramatic. So, but that said, Laura, actually, the way things unfold in the 1980s is not the way you're describing them. That is, that what I'm pointing to is this deeply rooted, what was called frequently dismissively, I must say, by the ANC, a workerist tendency. But to put it in Leninist terms, these are economistic trade unions. And that was a big no-no as far as the ANC was concerned. That was a problem. And one of the things that was created with the creation of COSATU was essentially the triumph of what's called the populist view in South African history, which was precisely the opposite of what you're saying, which is that the trade union movement should not confine itself to these, you know, economistic, limited notions of protecting workers on the shop floor and of lifting wages. That's reformist. That's not revolutionary. Rather, they should, you know, go out into the communities and address all of these questions, housing, sewage, you know, service delivery, party politics, and they should be down with the revolution. And that there was a big division in the union movement over that. And, you know, a bloody division at times, right? People were attacking each other over this. And you can go back, there's a wonderful speech. Now, that said, I think the workerists, that is the people who said, no, in doing that, that sounds good, but actually then the trade union is going to end up subordinating the interests of its membership, the working class, to the larger project of a nationalist revolution, which when push comes to shove will look just great, but then of course you're just gonna have the empowerment of a new bourgeoisie. And that in fact, see, I mean, from my view, this is exactly what happened, but COSATU is unwilling to admit it at this point, essentially. It is time for a divorce, but it's time for a divorce precisely because the trade union movement in South Africa followed that populist road. Right? And again, this is my analysis, or someone like Martin Legasek, I think, would argue the same thing. It's not a view everyone shares. But you go back to 82, and there's this fabulous speech by a leader of FOSATU called Joe Foster, which, you know, essentially says, look, we can join, we need to support the revolution through, the, in this case, the United Democratic Front, but we must maintain our autonomy and independence as a union movement, or else we're going to be swallowed up in a larger revolutionary project. And the end point of that is going to be liberation without liberation. And that's, you know, kind of what happened. So I think you're putting your finger on it. Now, the other side of it is, and here you could argue that the populist road did open up more space for women's activism, for example, right? And did address issues beyond the confines of this kind of male proletariat, right? And got away from this labor metaphysic, which people like Franco Barchesi, for instance, who was here, right, argue that essentially that labor metaphysic that's putting all of your eggs in the basket of liberating the working class, which is, you know, coded as male, as employed, as in the manufacturing sector, as proletarian, that is a very, very limited view of liberation, precisely because that class is just not that important anymore in a place where 40% unemployment rules. And so the community is something that you neglect at your peril. So there's a debate, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to go back a little earlier, and that is, you talk about the rise of secondary industrialism, but of course what precedes that is a long period of mining, and to some extent, the evolution of the Shaft-Stewart idea precedes some of the earlier effects. Do you find any carryover from that earlier period, and why it was, even though a lot of them were migratory, they come from outside and so on and so forth, in this notion of carrying it on, passing on some of the things that they came out of the dispute resolution in the mines, down in them itself, any of that carried on by going back?
It's a good question. I would say, on the one hand, I have deliberately bracketed my research to avoid looking at the mines, not because they're not important, but just because I feel those have been privileged as the story of South African capitalism and the South African labor movement, for that matter. But my guess is, Neil, that in fact, you know, that is a separate world. You know, again, maybe Peter could correct me here, but, you know, the mines are a separate world. They're governed by a particular political economy, export mining capital. They really depend really heavily on a migrant labor system. The workers live in hostels, right? I mean, it's a very important world. And it became the world that in many ways became shorthand for, you know, what's wrong with apartheid and how apartheid and capitalism are evil twins. Look at the mines. But there was, and they were very, very important in the first phase of 20th century South African capitalism. But by the 50s and 60s, they're becoming less important. Now, what degree did worker struggles in the mines, which had existed, which there's this mass strike in 1946, for example, and certainly when COSATU is born, you know, the mine workers union is, and if those of you who remember watching Nightline in the 1980s, the most eloquent South African, I thought, on Nightline, who kicked Piet Botha's ass night after night, was Cyril Ramaphosa, who became the head of the National Union of Mine Workers, the NUM, and now, I regret to tell you, sits on the board of the Lonmin Corporation, okay? So that says it all, and I was a great admirer of Ramaphosa's. And I know his niece, who's, you know, a friend of mine, and, you know, boy, that says it all. So, to get back to your question, though, so what degree has been there sort of a tradition or a legacy of struggle in the mines that carries over into the Durban moment? I don't really think so. They go home and they talk.
They come back.
Yeah, they do go home. And
the next generation at home may come back in a different...
And into factories, or their brothers or their sons may go work in factories. It's very possible. I haven't seen any evidence of that yet, but it's a place to look. No, that's good. Yes. All right. So that's, yeah. That may well be the case. Yeah. So, and then Peter was reminding me that strike in Namibia, Peter, the Ovamba strike. Is that a minor strike? But the other strike that sort of is sort of the precursor to the 73 strikes is the dock worker strike in Durban. In late 72. So, and there's a long tradition of struggle there, including syndicalist struggle. So you can, I mean, I found great material on the 50s where you have dock workers, casualized labor, on the South African docks who are engaging in slowdowns and sick outs. I mean, I have some really, and that's through these labor board negotiations. So shipping companies are calling up the labor board saying, none of our guys showed up for work today. What's going on? You know, go get the police and make them come to work. So there's some really good evidence of that. That certainly carries over, but I've yet to see, and it's something I should look for, that's sort of the carryover from the consciousness that's being forged in the minds.
Well, please let us give Alex one more hand.
Thank you all for great questions.
All afternoon.
Yes.